We're going to start our little session here. We like to do that by making the sound of Om together. We'll focus on our breath for three breaths to begin. And with a deep in breath. Satchidananda, the Bhagavad Gita, a path for personal spiritual transformation. Satchidananda's commentary in the Bhagavad Gita, our focus is on practical spiritual advice. I'm going to start with a verse from chapter 3 of the Tao Te Ching. Last week we talked about what the enlightened person is like. How do they talk and walk and speak and sit? And someone commented that, well, I have friends and their whole life is about making money. That's their whole life. And if they didn't have that goal of making money, I'm guessing their life would be without purpose. Without purpose. And I thought about that this week, and it reminded me of this verse from the Tao Te Ching, chapter 3. The master, or the enlightened person, leads by emptying people's minds and filling their cores, by weakening their ambition and toughening their resolve. Emptying people's minds, he empties them of concepts, judgments, and desires. Thus, they can return to a state of childlike simplicity. Filling their cores, he fills them with a sense of their original identity. Thus, they can return to a state of joy. Filling their cores, he fills them with a sense of their original identity. Thus, they can return to a state of joy. Weakening their ambition, when they have no false self to nourish or defend, they find that greed, hatred, and arrogance vanish by themselves. Toughening their resolve, their innermost intention, they develop enough self-reliance to give up the idea of self. For example, making money for myself.
It seems easier when your cultural upbringing supports it, right? So when we're learning about how we want to become more independent or self-sufficient, one way to do that in our culture is to find a job and, you know, bring income in so we can find shelter and food and transportation. So.
Yes, when we're little kids, what's the question the adults ask us? What do you want to be when you grow up? And then if you're a senior in high school, like my grandson is, the question they ask is, what do you want to major in? Mm-hmm. Right. What do you want to do after you graduate from school?
And whereas in this culture, my guess is that they don't ask those specific questions to drive that. Right.
Well, I don't know. I just saw on YouTube an article about the ancient Egyptians, about whom we have many misconceptions. From the time of the Greeks around Christ.
Interesting.
Right? When the Egyptian civilization had been around for 2,000 years, now it's another 2,000, the Greeks were very prejudiced against the Egyptians. Prejudice. So they, Herodotus made the myth that, those great pyramids, which the Greeks had never done anything comparable, they said, they were constructed by slaves. Slaves. And of course they weren't. They were constructed by religious, skilled artisans who were paid and were honored to be able to construct these mighty monuments, just as similar people constructed the cathedrals in Europe and the great Greek temples and so on. It's easy to look at people from another culture and another time as different. The amazing thing I think we find out is how much we're the same.
Yeah.
How much we're the same. The Master helps people lose everything they know, everything they desire, and creates confusion in those who think they know. Morning, Joe. I brought this verse just for you today.
With divine timing.
Oh.
Welcome.
You had asked last week, I don't know if you remember, we were talking about the enlightened person, and you mentioned some friends of yours whose whole life was about making money. And you brought up that in your way of looking at it, what would they do if they didn't have that goal of making money? They would have no purpose in life. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of this verse from the Tao Te Ching, which I brought today to share. I'll repeat it again, and the Master, that's us, of course, leads by emptying people's minds and filling their cores, by weakening their ambition and toughening their resolve. Weakening their ambition when people have no false self to nourish or defend, they find that greed, hatred, and arrogance vanish by themselves. He helps people lose everything they know, everything they desire, and creates confusion in those who think they know. By helping people lose everything they know, as we go in the process of learning everything we know, we return our minds to our original childlike state of openness and receptivity, and lose some of the judgments and opinions and barriers to our original childlike receptivity. Questions on the verse?
All right. Let's see if I can jump ahead now. I can. Good. So here we are. Last week we looked at these five verses, which are the attributes of someone who is enlightened. And I brought some copies of these.
take these home with you, if you wish. Last week we just went through the verses and we didn't get to the commentary. So I'm going to move through the verses a little more quickly today, and then we'll get to the commentary of Satchitananda. So here we go, 55. An evolved or enlightened person. A person who has let go of all personal desires. Remember that? And is utterly content in the truth of the Atman, or the true self, or the inner divinity, is one of steady wisdom. So that's the first one, desires. 56 says, a person undisturbed by difficulties, who doesn't yearn to be happy, who has no favorites, no fear, and no anger, is a sage of steady wisdom. Undisturbed by difficulties. 57. Whoever is free of all mental attachments, who is not excited when good happens, good things happen, nor dejected when evil comes, is poised in wisdom. Fifty-eight, when one can withdraw the senses from sense objects, like a tortoise withdraws within, his wisdom is unwavering. Withdraw the senses from sense objects.
So that is that referring to the five senses, to the sight, the hear, the smell, taste, touch,
right,
and not being attached to it. Like when we say, I love ice cream or ice cream sundae, I love berries. Just letting go,
right,
becoming aware.
Withdraw the senses, right. Satchitananda and I were talking about this. So withdraw from the senses means to notice that we have them, but the senses aren't who we are. The senses aren't who we are. So sitting here, for example, your tummy might be requesting some food or drink. And the request of your tummy may be so strong that it draws your mind to focus on that. And the thoughts go there, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty. I wonder when this is going to be over so I can go satisfy my thirst or my hunger. Or with the eyes, you may have some desire to see something, hear something. And that desire to satisfy the senses may occupy your mind and take your mind from being present. Can we have senses but not let the senses have us? Can we find an inner discernment to notice what the senses want and what is best for us, or what our innermost resolution is? Thank you, Sam. And lastly, 59, by abstaining from sense objects, they will drop away mentally. They're still there, drop away mentally. Longing for them will also disappear upon realizing the highest truth. We have them, we recognize them. It's just our longing. We may have longing as well, but we're not attached to the longing. We just notice. It's part of our human condition.
I think it's easier to do it within ourselves so that, I mean, for example, like, how do you abstain from sense objects, like, let's say, a computer when it's required, you know, for communications and or, you know, just to from our everyday practice and work, right? Or maybe it's how do you abstain from?
Perhaps abstain is the wrong word, or not the most accurate word. Rather, who chooses where we give our attention? When what is ours to do is to be with the computer and do a computer thing, can we let our attention be focused on that sense object and not be distracted by other sense objects? Some people think it's a great talent to be able to do many different things at once. Actually, it's a distraction.
Yeah. Right.
The true talent is to be able to focus on one thing at a time and do that well. For example, a communication between yourself and a friend. If a friend is communicating with you and saying something that's deeply important to them, and your focus on the person and receptivity to that person be so intense that even if a parrot lands on their head, you don't bring it up. Focus on the communication. Now later on you might say, by the way, you know, a parrot landed on your head when we were communicating. Thank you, Sam. Here's Satchitananda's commentary. You may control the senses, but impressions from past desires, which is a Sanskrit word for it, it's called vasanas, are still there. Sanskrit is a language rich in words for the spiritual ideas. Vasana is a word for impressions from past desires that live within us, that can inadvertently arise. Somebody can stimulate it inadvertently. You remember this past desire. And there's a word for it called vasanas. We have vasanas. You may not be enjoying the objects of your desires, but that doesn't mean you are completely free from them. And the sanas, which are these desires, it may not be present for you in the moment, your enjoyment of it, but it doesn't mean you're free from them. You may have a little longing still. Sometimes when people fast, even though they are away from food, unfortunately, they think more about food. Has anyone here ever gone on a fast? Yes. In your experience during the fast, did the thought of food come up? It did. That's interesting. That's natural and very human. And Satchitananda points out that it's unfortunate, even though they're away from food, fortunately they think more about food. Because the purpose of a fast is to be free from food and experience that freedom, to be totally focused on some other place that we're resolved to focus on. And yet, as you observe, sometimes we think about food and fasting. So just staying away from the desires is not enough, he says. The question really is, how do we get rid of this longing, those vasanas? Those vasanas, those desires. I use a little technique at night when I go to sleep. It suits me. As I'm laying there, what do I want to focus on? The mind can easily jump around different places and keep me from going to sleep. My habit is I focus on what I'm going to have for breakfast. And I go through the process. There's other processes for going to sleep. You start with your toes and focus on your toes and your foot and so on. I use breakfast. I look at all the choices for breakfast I have, I pick one, and then I make it. So imagining the ingredients and so on. Usually by the time I'm done, I've gone to sleep. And I have an agreement with myself, which is, although that's a fine thing to have for breakfast, I don't necessarily have to have that the next morning if that's not working for me. But it does work for me to stimulate that vasana in me. There's a sleep technique. How do we get rid of those longings, those vasanas inside? The answer is not by force, but by real understanding of the truth. Ask yourself, who is eating the food? Am I, or is it my body?
It's interesting, huh? The separation
between. Ask yourself, who is eating the food? Am I, or is it my body? Who's tasting the food? Am I tasting it, or is it my tongue? It's the body that longs for the food, the tongue, and the tummy that's growling. I'm not hungry. I'm not thirsty. What a great leap of imagination that is. I am not hungry. I'm not thirsty. My body is hungry or thirsty. My stomach is rumbling. My taste buds are salivating. Have you ever gone into a room where they're baking bread and it's not so good? Years ago when I was in real estate, they recommended when you have an open house, you add some aroma to the open house. Baking bread was, if you could manage,
grab a pot,
the best one.
Or something, yeah.
Pot. People walk in the house and they'll never forget that aroma. Helps people decide what house they want to sell. Want to buy, sorry. And yet, when we walk into that house and we smell the baking bread, Satchitananda suggests to remind ourselves, I'm not hungry. The body's hungry. As a spiritual practice. When you're rooted in this truth, then he suggests even the longing goes away. When you're rooted, when you've adopted it as a spiritual practice. Not me, it's my senses. My master used to sing a song. I'm not the body, not the mind. Immortal self, I am. Even Satchitananda's guru, his teacher, needed assistance to keep this spiritual principle in mind. So he sang it. He sang it to support him transcending his humanity, in a sense, and to embody the spiritual principle. I'm not the body, not the mind. Immortal self am I. What do we sing as we're in our car driving to church or going to work? What do we sing when we're in the grocery line and we notice we got in the longest line and the clerk has gone off to see the manager because there's an issue with someone paying and we realize it's going to be a long wait and people have gotten into all the other lines, so we might as well stay there. What song do we sing to ourselves? I'm not the body, not the mind. Immortal self am I, is the song that Satchitananda's teacher sang. When you're rooted in that, then you'll look at the body and say, hey, you're not really hungry, you've eaten enough. There's a lot of storage. You're not really hungry, you eat. I have extra storage. Every now and then I get extra storage. I can tell when I get on the scale and it tells me I'm 10 pounds overweight. Extra storage. finish up all that, whatever you're eating, and I'll give you some more later on. We're sitting at the dinner table. We've taken our normal portion, which in my case is a little extra. And we tell the body, look, just eat your portion, not that extra amount. Later on, I'll give you some more later on. And you won't dwell on it. You won't dwell on it. That's why they say when you realize the Supreme, even the longing goes away. And yet this is a spiritual practice, isn't it? We all have our habits. My habit is to put a little extra on my plate. I've done that since I've been a kid. And I had some encouragement when I was a kid. Of course, I was thin then, no matter how much I ate, I stayed thin. My mother used to say, oh, you have a hollow leg. She loved me. So I had some encouragement about overeating, even as a child. You have a hollow leg, Steve. And I developed that habit. And I transform my habits by new spiritual practices. And remember, our habits are rooted not only in things we repeat to ourselves, but also in emotions which are embedded in our bodies, the feeling of being loved, for example. Feeling of being loved, which we carry in our heart. And our habits are attached to feelings that are in other places in our body. That's why sometimes we find it a challenge to change habits we know we should change and maintain the ones that are good for us and honor them.
Sounds like the self-awareness is really the attribute, the key attribute there. What happens when you get beyond that and you're back into your patterns or reactivity of thought? I guess if you can't recognize that those underlying unconscious thoughts are there, how do you work with that?
The first step in any spiritual work is always discernment, noticing. Ah, there my pattern came up again. That's it. Once you notice, ah, there my pattern came up again, with the other spiritual practices that you've been working on, you will know automatically where to go from there. But while it's invisible or just part of an unconscious pattern, it persists. You may notice this if you have a meditation practice. You're meditating, it's wonderful, you're focused on something or another. And then all of a sudden you wake up and notice your mind went away and started thinking about some other things for a while and went down this whole path of associations, you know, one word, one associate, into this, into that. And all of a sudden you wake up and notice that your mind is wandering. And if you have a sincere spiritual practice, you know what to do, which is to bring your mind back to your meditation object and continue. It's also important not to be down on ourselves, but to celebrate ourselves. So if our minds run away, like monkey minds, we say, thank you, God bless you, I've got a wonderful monkey mind, I'm so grateful for it. However, monkey mind, I'm going to ask you to quiet down a bit now. The real eye focuses on this meditation practice. So you're not even your mind has life in its own. And be grateful for it. And notice, like your tummy, it leads you in different directions. Come back to noticing that. Continue with the spiritual practice to which you've made a resolution. This is what I want to do. And be grateful for all of it.
Thank you.
As we move along our spiritual path, Satchitananda promises, if you practice these things, there comes a point where you don't dwell on it. And that's why they say when you realize the Supreme, realize the Supreme, even in the waiting line at the grocery store, in your car, even the longing goes away.
So that's accomplished by meditation, realizing the Supreme?
I would say spiritual practices, and meditation is probably an essential spiritual practice. A meditation practice, according to the Bhagavad Gita, is the bedrock of a spiritual practice. There are other aspects that are equally important, dedicating what we do as a service to others, dedicating what we do as a service to others, not as something for ourselves. Another spiritual practice is to choose a mantra. We heard what Satchitananda's master's mantra was. I am not the mind, I am the body. That was his mantra. Something that he could say over and over and again to keep him in the place where he wished to be. In the Christian tradition, sometimes people choose the mantra, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. Just a thing you say rather than have your mind wander. In the Hindu tradition, they will often say Ram, 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 which is the word for God. This was the mantra of Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. And when he died, those next to him heard, after he was shot and was falling to the ground, he repeated, Ram, 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 and then he passed. In the Buddhist tradition, it's Om Mane Padme Hum, I believe. It's a recommended mantra. All spiritual traditions recommend a mantra. In the Catholic tradition, what is it, Mother Mary, and so on. In order to allow us to be in our deepest truth more often, rather than tossed about by our mental inclinations. Did that answer your question, Joe?
Yes, kind of yes, but so when you say realizing the Supreme, I mean, can you give more definition to what exactly that means, or you can't really, each person is different, I guess, realizing the Supreme.
Realizing the Supreme, good question. It's one of those assertions that no one can probably understand until they realize it and they say, oh, that's what that's called. We go to the Unity Church. Unity. Are we in a state of unity right now? We're in the Unity Church. Are we in a state of unity where we are in unity with the universe? Where our experience is that I am a part of the universe. The universe is part of me. That's an experience. That's similar to realizing the Supreme. So different words for something that once you experience, someone says, well, what's that like? How do I explain it? And depending on the cultural setting, one would use different words. And yet, it's one of those things that probably doesn't have a good name. Because as soon as you give something a name, it makes it this and that. It makes it this and not that. Whereas that experience is probably everything. It's all of it. The experience of being at one with the universe. Good question. Can we pass beyond the names and look for what we're guessing that experience might be? As long as you're still striving, be extremely careful not to be deceived by overconfidence, thinking, I've achieved everything, now I'm completely in control. Satchidananda is going further down this spiritual path. He recognizes that perhaps in himself or in others, they were so successful in their spiritual practice, they thought, now I got it. Now I got it. I've achieved everything. I'm in control. He points out you can be deceived at any time, and Lord Krishna has a warning about it. And it comes up in the next two slokas in the Bhagavad Gita. However, our time is up. It's 11 o'clock, so we probably need to close now. Unless you'd like to stay for a bit more. 11 o'clock is a good time to close. Any questions, further questions before we close, or comments? And next time, we'll look at the warning. Let's close by focusing all of our attention on our breath for three breaths. And with a deep in-breath, and go in peace with your vasanas, your internalized desires that pop up when you least expect them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next week, the morning.
The morning.